Welcome to Thriveology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Phil Dunwoody, that's me.
And Neil Lutterbach, that's me. Phil and I are both faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses on human thriving and well-being. This is part two of our mindfulness exploration. If you didn't check out part one, go ahead and do that. In today's podcast, we're going to briefly discuss the body's stress response and how mindfulness can help you regulate it. How two section, we'll go over some of the bells and whistles of an actual practice very briefly. And then we'll talk about our own practices and how we came to them and how we continue to tinker with them.
Yeah. Yeah, so the stress response is, I think, a huge thing, right? So this is something that you and I talk about with our students a lot because, well, our students, like us at times, can be very stressed. So the way I talk about this with students, right, and the way I talk about stress in general is to think about it from an evolutionary perspective. Mm. We have evolved mechanisms to help us deal with short-term emergencies in our environment that are they're survival focused, right? And so, you know, you've heard about the fight or flight response, and people also talk about that as fight, flight, or freeze response, right? So this is the body stress response. It is the sympathetic nervous system, essentially when it detects some threat in the environment, kicking into high gear to prepare you to survive, again, the short-term emergency. So what does this mean? Like, what does your body do? Well, there's this kind of flood of hormones. Cortisol is increased in your bloodstream. The effects of this short term, from an evolutionary perspective, they do make some sense. Some of them are a little odd, right? But like, if you think about digestion, is not something your body needs to spend a lot of energy on if you're trying to survive some immediate attack, right? So your body shuts down digestion as part of your body's stress response, right? Again, short term, that makes sense. Your brain, particularly the frontal lobe, uses just a ton of oxygen, right? It's very, very energy rich. It's expensive to run. So your brain actually, your body's stress response reduces blood flow to the frontal lobe. So the frontal lobe, for those of you who don't know, this is what we call kind of central executive functioning. This is kind of all of our deliberate planning about the future, our inhibition of kind of basic impulses. These are really, really important things, obviously, on a daily basis. Other things your stress response does, right? Well, in a short-term emergency, you might need to go a day or two without sleeping, right, to escape the threat. So, okay, this makes sense in the short term, right? Shut down digestion, shut down sleeping, shut down the frontal lobe, or at least reduce blood flow, sending all that kind of extra energy to the muscles, right? And so again, kind of short-term survival. But what happens then is when we're stressed, this system is activated long-term. Like, we don't have separate stress response systems for short-term stressors and long-term stressors. Right. So the thing we have that evolved for this, like, okay, saber-toothed tiger or whatever, right, you know, intertribal conflict, you can be stressed for months, years, right? And this same system then winds up chronically activated. And while we talked about this a little bit in the first episode where kind of one of my own awakenings about stress was being in a biological foundations of behavior class where I was copying the symptoms of chronic stress and realized that that was me, right? That's what was going on. So this is why we actually need tools to learn to regulate our energy, our energy level, right? Because the sympathetic system is in that fight or flight. We need to be able to recognize it, and we need to be able to essentially do things like deep breathing, things that engage the parasympathetic nervous system that help really tamp down that that threat response, right? That stress response.
And I think it's important to recognize that, you know, our bodies don't know kinds of threat.
Right.
They just
right.
know degrees. So anything that we'll talk about sort of homeostasis, you know, like anything that sends me out of homeostasis, if I ask you to sit down or stand up, to the body's perspective, that's a stress. It's a very, very low stressor, but it's a change out of my homeostasis. And so to your point, like we evolved for those acute, immediate threats, not this sort of low-grade, chronic, under the sort of vibrating threat that we go through all day long.
Right, right. So if you're, you know, in a work environment that, you know, maybe you have colleagues that you find particularly stressful to be around, or your job itself is inherently stressful, you know, there's a certain amount of that that you can tolerate and may even be healthy, right? Mm-hmm. But at some point you are degrading the body, right? This is ultimately what it comes down to. If that system is activated for extended periods of time, too much, the long-term consequences on your health are just really bad. And this is why we want to be aware of it and be able to regulate it.
Well, and you brought up a really important point too. Like, you know, when we ask our students at sort of the beginning of the semester, what constitutes a good life for you? They sometimes say, well I'll be stress-free or some. It's like, that's not necessarily the goal because as you pointed out, some stress is desirable. The sort of process of hormesis is those sort of smaller, infrequent doses of stress actually strengthen our bodies, our immune systems, our minds. Learning is a stress, but it obviously improves our intelligence, our mind. So we want those. We're not trying to be stress-free. We're just trying to regulate some of that.
Right, right. And then that's, I think, where the mindfulness comes in really. Mm-hmm. It is really helpful because in order to regulate, you actually have to notice, right? And that's what I mentioned, that when I was in that first semester in grad school, copying down all the symptoms of chronic stress, the eye opener to me was apparently I was suffering from chronic stress and I hadn't noticed. Mm-hmm. I didn't know to actually pay attention to those signals my body was sending me. I knew it was happening, but I didn't know how to interpret them. I didn't know what was going on, right? So part of the mindful practice, really tuning into where are you at, right, in the present moment, kind of feeling your body, you know, your breath, right, your background level of anxiety, of activation, of stress, and then having the tools to be able to down-regulate if necessary, right, calm yourself. So I think that's where we get into some of the vagus nerve activation.
Yeah, so you know, Phil talked about sort of the sympathetic, parasympathetic sides of your autonomic nervous system, and As maybe unintuitive as it might seem, you actually want those two systems sort of combating each other for dominance. If one's too much activated over the other, that's when we start getting into problems. And that fight shows up in what's called heart rate variability, or HRV. And so you actually have a slight variation in your heartbeat. It's not sort of the arrhythmia that becomes sort of medically problematic, but it's this normal slight variation. You want a high degree of that variation. And part of that communication happens via what's called the vagus nerve, or the vagal nerve network. And vagus is just Latin for wandering. It's also the same root we get vagabond. And it's this 10th of 12 cranial nerves. And it starts at the brainstem and wanders through your body, making contact with some of the throat apparatus involved in swallowing. It goes around the heart, the lungs, into your digestion, and it's sending signals back and forth, the body to the brain, brain to the body. And it's principally responsible, has a whole host of functions. Principally, it's responsible for regulating that nervous system activation. So when it senses the threat has passed, its job is to help tone down some of that activation to enter into a parasympathetic rest or digest state. And we can intentionally activate it and help it get into that state through some things like mindfulness and breath work. Mm-hmm. But it's really interesting, and we won't go into too much detail about it today. Some of this will come up again when we go into our nutrition section and sleep, frankly, too. But that communication is not only happening in sort of me, but it's also in the sort of critters that live with me, in the microbiome. And in particular, they're sending signals through this, it's sort of a human ethernet through the body, through this vagus nerve, from the gut and to the brain and back down through this vagus nerve. And what's interesting, some of the research is showing that when there's a dysregulation in that system, is partly contributing to diseases like Parkinson's and Alzheimer's, that there's something going on that's not helping that communication signal. And some of it, again, is nutritionally oriented. We can talk about that. But stress in it, we know, of course, that chronic stress dysregulates the gut microbiome. Mm-hmm. And so when that's dysregulated, then the signals are getting jammed up in that vagus nerve to the brain. And there's a whole host. And even the authors, this is a paper by Han et al., Vagus Nerve and Underlying Impact of the Gut Microbiota, Brain Axis in Behavior and Neurodegenerative Diseases. Even they admit that we don't fully know the mechanisms.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, Phil and I are going to talk about our model is a systems. We as academics are very quick to talk about like mental health and physical health and spiritual health as sort of discrete categories. But as a lived experience, it's all intermingled.
It's all connected.
It's all connected. Everything's connected.
Yeah. And even you talk about some people start referring to the second brain.
Right.
Right. Yep. Because of that, the idea of like, oh, well, first brain is exactly what you think of up top. Right. And then you have the vagus nerve connecting to the second brain, which is the gut. Right. This kind of huge network, neural network that that actually gives us. And this shows up in our common language. I have a gut feeling.
Right. Yeah.
Right? Right. And how many of us like experience threat or stress in our gut? Like that's right. One of the first ways places I feel it is my gut tightens up. And if I'm eating, that means I'm not going to be digesting very well. My threat response is elevated. I'm inhibiting my own digestion. Right. So this is where the deep breathing helps kind of activate the vagus nerve to kick the parasympathetic nervous system into a higher gear and reduce your body's stress response. So part of that stress response shows up in cortisol in the blood.
Mm-hmm.
So you can do, or in saliva actually. So you can do saliva samples from people kind of before and after a period of just deep breathing. And you see noticeable, measurable declines in cortisol, right? The kind of just from deep breathing. So this is, you know, again, back to the why, which we covered a lot of in kind of part one, more a little bit more of the research around mindfulness. This is part of the why. And this also gets into this area. We refer to this zone of optimal functioning. This is something that kind of comes out of sports psychology, but it has older roots. The Yerkes-Dodson laws are kind of a law that describes the relationship between stress and human performance to kind of say that there's this optimal zone, right? That essentially too little stress. And really what you're saying is you don't care if you do well, right?
Right, like, right.
I'm not concerned about my performance. And so you want enough stress to kind of motivate you to do well, to practice, to perform well. But there's a tipping point, right? And you get more stress beyond that, and your performance starts to really decline. So that is, in a slightly different way, what's described in this zone of optimal functioning, where you don't want hyper or hypo arousal, right? Mm-hmm. We all have this target zone that we're comfortable in. Really, not comfortable, but where our body is optimal, right? Where we can function at peak performance. And that's where we want to learn to operate. So the key then is noticing when you are outside of that zone. So I think, you know, that I've heard people talk about this with regard to mindfulness in a couple ways. One is learning to notice when you're outside of the zone so you can kind of self-regulate to get back in it, but also to kind of expand where that zone is for you. Kind of
the boundaries of that zone.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Exactly. So that some level of hyperarousal is less disruptive to you now than it would have been at some point.
And we'll talk about this more when we get into like doing hard things as well. But where, you know, even we talk about this in sort of exercise size, is like most of your workout happens in that zone. And then, you know, once a week or so, you want to push pretty hard. You want to really stretch that boundary a little bit. And that's true for our, you know, mental acuity, our spiritual health, all those things. We want to push ever so often, not chronically, but ever so often.
Yeah, that's this Saturday. I've got a half trail marathon scheduled. 3,500 feet of elevation gain.
I did skip that one.
Yeah. So, but all of this, like, so this relates, you know, with my kind of Qigong practice and Tai Chi, and even in yoga, we talk about regulating your energy, mm-hmm. right? And energy being just that, right? Kind of being aware of, like, am I kind of overactivated, underactivated, and how do I regulate that through breathing, right? And again, get to that kind of zone of optimal functioning. So it's probably a good time to go into some of the how-to. With Neil and I were talking about this podcast, one of the discussions was, guided meditation with a whole lot of dead silence probably doesn't make for the most exciting podcast. So this is something, if you listen to apps, right, guided meditation, some of them have also call heavy guidance, right, mm-hmm. meaning there's just a lot of it, and others have lots of dead space, right? And like my personal preference is generally more dead space. I like that, but that would make for a very weird podcast. So we want to kind of walk you through a couple of examples, but we're going to be fairly heavy on the guidance, and we're going to keep them short.
Very short, yeah. And I think it's also good at this point to sort of frame, if this is totally new to you, some of the common experiences you might have in any of these exercises. Mind is going to wander.
Oh, yeah.
It's going to wander a lot, and that's okay. Like, we're not trying to stop or control the thoughts. We're trying to notice them, and in the noticing, we can redirect or expand our awareness around them so they have less of a hold on us. Or there's lots of analogies. I often think about, if you're old enough to remember the video game Frogger, mm-hmm. you were a frog and you had to jump through traffic. And if you got sort of stuck in, if you got the little frog in traffic, he'd end up getting run over. And so it's not necessarily the goal of that game, but if we sit on the side of the road and just watch the cars, we don't get sort of in the traffic of it. We're outside of that. And so those thoughts, whether it's traffic or a stream or like, we're just watching it go by.
Yeah, kind of that awareness, right?
Awareness.
A lot of mindfulness is about awareness. And this is where I think a lot of people get tripped up. And we talked about this a little bit in episode one, and that they think they're doing it wrong,
right?
Because they meditate and they don't instantly have this sense of calmness and peace kind of flowing over them, right? And that's not it. It's not, mindfulness is not, it's not about calmness. Calmness comes and goes, right? Mm-hmm. You know, feelings of peace come and go. It's really about cultivating awareness of where you are. So yes, you might feel calm, but you might feel like a ping pong ball. Yeah. Either way, awareness is there, and you can kind of listen to, well, where am I at now?
And some of that ping ponging may be in your mind. It may be in your body. So as we talked about, like, that chronic stress shows up in our nervous system. So I often start, you know, at the beginning of the semester, particularly with students, and they're fidgeting, they're moving around. Like, that's okay, because that's just your nervous system trying. It's not used to just settling down.
Yeah.
It's used to having to go, go, go. And now you're inviting it to just be still. That takes a while.
It does, right? And so as we go into this practice, I mean, I'll just share that when I first started a regular mindfulness practice, one of the things I learned about myself, and it's often referred to as insight meditation, right? For this reason, because you learn things about yourself, is that my mind always went to planning,
mm-hmm.
right? It always went to kind of doing things, because that is what I spent my whole, that's what I was always doing. I was always planning for a class, planning for a meeting, planning for an event, planning for something. And so it was very hard for me to get to a point where I could sit and rest in what we sometimes call resting in open awareness, because I hadn't developed the habit of it,
mm-hmm.
right? We are habit machines. Our brains are habit machines. And so so if any of this is new to you, yeah, again, don't berate yourself for not doing it well. The goal is awareness. It's to notice where you are. And so when I sit for my morning practice, my only goal is to sit for a certain amount of time and notice where I am. Whatever happens during that time is okay, right? So for the first one, this is kind of one of my go-to practices called belly breathing. So we'll say first, if you happen to be driving while listening to this, you know, make sure you keep your eyes open and you stay alert enough to properly operate your vehicle. I think you can do these to some extent while you're driving, right? Like, but for me, this is a practice I typically do sitting, sometimes standing. I mean, I will engage some of these while I'm doing other things. This brings up differences between like mindfulness meditation versus just mindfulness. Mm-hmm. But the belly breathing, if you first get in kind of whatever is a comfortable position for you. If you're standing, I'd say just try and get where your weight is evenly distributed on your feet. If you're sitting, try and get in a position that is comfortable. You might be able to get your spine kind of somewhat upright in a way that is alert but yet relaxed. And to start with, I'd say put your hands on your belly, right? So that as you inhale and you take a nice deep breath, you notice the expansion of your belly, right? Kind of, you know, pressing out with the diaphragm. And then as you exhale, right, that contraction. So for a few breaths, what I want you to do is notice that belly expanding and contracting. Inhale and exhale. And don't worry if your inhale and exhale don't match mine. Your breath length might be different. And this, you can expand to now notice the flow of air on your nostrils. And maybe even the back of the throat as you inhale, tracing that breath down into the lower lungs, feeling the expansion of the belly. Exhale, tracing that path back up, noticing the exhale. So this simple practice of belly breathing, it's my favorite. It's my go-to, right? And the reason it has the impact that we've talked about in terms of lowering the sympathetic response, right? And kind of getting a better balance if I'm feeling stressed. And one of the reasons I love it is that if I'm in a meeting that is stressful, right? And I notice kind of that I'm tensing my shoulders or I'm feeling it in my gut, I just start doing this belly breathing. Nobody knows, right? It's not like I'm advertising it.
Right.
And so it's just a wonderful, relaxing tool that you can use any place, anywhere.
And the second exercise is related to that deep belly breath. It's a little more structured in what is often in sort of yogic traditions referred to as pranayama. Prana just is Sanskrit for breath or energy or life. Yama is control, so it's just breath control, essentially. So it's a very structured way to breathe. And this was first introduced to me by a former Navy SEAL, Commander Mark Devine. And the SEALs would use it, Commander Devine would use it in very stressful situations. And it has sort of a multifold purpose. One, it activates that deep belly breath, but it also gives the mind something very concrete to focus on. And we'll talk about the difference between the sort of open and focused attention. This is a very focused attention exercise. And that can be beneficial. We think about sort of the Buddhist tradition. They often talk about sort of monkey mind. Mm-hmm. And if we just give the monkeys jumping from branch to branch, if I just give it a banana, it'll settle down. And so for me, I often use box breathing, particularly in similar ways that Phil uses the belly breath, because sometimes I just need a little extra oomph in there to focus what is a very active mind. And so it basically makes a box. You inhale through the nose for roughly four counts, but it can be any time. Inhale for four counts through the nose. You'll hold that full breath for four counts. You'll exhale through the nose for four counts. And you'll hold the empty lungs for four counts. And go ahead. You were going to say something.
No, it's to help. I think you're drawing the picture, which people who might watch see it, right? But right. But if you're listening, right? So could, because you are, as you're doing this, I think you're visualizing tracing the outline of a box, right? So we can say that inhale for four breaths, you can imagine tracing up a box, like the side of a box, right? Hold, you're tracing across the top. Exhale, tracing down the bottom.
Or you can make a little house. Talk about the wall, the roof, the wall, and the floor.
That's got too much baggage. let's keep the box.
And one of the other things you might notice as we go into this is at that bottom empty lung hold, your body may give you signals, little alarm bells, and say, hey, Neil, I don't have air. Take a breath. But you know what your body doesn't, and that is in four counts, you're going to get some air. So we can put some distance between the signal and my response. And that in and of itself has been a really radical lesson for me, not always exercised perfectly, but attempted, that I don't have to simply react to the signal. I can choose to respond. So let's give it a go. Same structure, finding a seated position, maybe not while you're driving, but keep your eyes open.
Yeah, visualizing things while you're driving might be a bad idea because it does engage the occipital lobe, which leaves less resources available for actual visual processing.
So we'll just do just a couple rounds of this. You can exhale all the air out to start, and then all together, inhaling through the nose. Hold, two, three, four. Exhale through the nose, two, three, four. Hold the empty lungs, two, three, four. Inhale, belly, ribs, chest, hold. Exhale, chest, ribs, belly, hold, two, three, four. Inhale, belly, ribs, chest, hold, two, three, four. Exhale, chest, ribs, belly, hold, two, three, four. And then you can just let your breath return to normal. So you could do, I often do 5 minutes of that. 5 minutes gets me, we'll talk about when we get into practice why maybe 5 minutes, but you could do that for any length of time. Three rounds of that is great. We just did a couple rounds there, and you know, you may have already experienced some ease as well.
I do like the extra focus that brings.
I do.
One of the things we talk about in cognitive psychology is that the brain doesn't work on negatives very well. You can't tell yourself not to think of something, but what you can do is give your mind something else to think about, right? And so this box breathing gives you that something else to think about, right, that engages attention, which just leaves less available for kind of that rumination or whatever, right, planning for the future, thinking about the past, et cetera.
And sometimes I think for me also the time domains are immediately manageable. So if I think I'm going to sit down and just do my mindfulness practice for 20 minutes, to some people that can feel like a really long time, right? Yeah. And what I also like about this as a metaphor is like you just have to inhale and then you just have to hold and then you just have to exhale and then you just have to hold and you just have to inhale and just have to hold, right? They're just these, just do the next thing.
One step at a time.
Yeah. That's all you need to do. Similarly, we can do a body scan, and there's a couple different ways you can do this. We're going to just do sort of an awareness scan. And so, again, sitting comfortably, I like to think of like a medical scanner sort of like zzz down my body, sort of making a mental map of the body. So just sitting comfortably, letting the body come to settle, and maybe starting at the top of the head, see if you can bring your attention to the top. As you gently scan down, bringing your awareness to the forehead and the back of the head, down to the eyes and the ears, the cheeks, down to the mouth, the neck, down the shoulders and the chest, the upper back, down the arms, scanning down the rib cage, not trying to make a story out of it, just noticing, taking note of how the body feels today without judgment, through the belly, scanning down the hips, the thighs, the knees, the calves, and the feet. And then if you noticed some place where there's a particular amount of tension in the body, see if you can gently return there and invite some warmth, some ease. See if you can let go of something you don't need. Let go of that tension. And then you can return your attention back to the world.
This is another favorite of mine, I have to admit. I do this one a lot. And the part that I kind of visually add to myself to what you're doing is as I do that scan, I'm kind of imagining this wave of relaxation going through my body so that I am noticing any tension that's there, but I'm imagining it just kind of drain out of my body, kind of going down that same path, out my hands, out my feet. I do that one a lot.
Yeah, I think both of those, you know, we talked about sort of two different perspectives. One could take the scanning the body without judgment, and then scanning with the intention of trying to invite some more ease. Yeah. And I think for me, scanning without judgment was and continues to be really important because I know I hold a lot of self-criticism about my body, about what should be or shouldn't be, what's good, what's bad. And even as I do a scan, it's like, oh, what's that about? Why is that there? And I start making a whole story about why my neck is sore. And I just like, just can I just notice?
Just notice, yeah. Just notice. Yeah.
But you're absolutely right. That's inviting some of that ease can be absolutely beneficial as well.
Yeah, well, that relaxation, I think of it in terms of, you know, some of my yoga practice or my Tai Chi practice in Chinese medicine, they talk about kind of tension in the body as part of what creates illness, right? And kind of learning to relax. And, you know, when I work with students in Tai Chi, it's amazing how much tension they'll just hold in their body all the time. And like, okay, how much of that do you really need? Kind of learning. So I guess I spend so much time focused on that.
Well, you and I often talk about the similarities between Tai Chi and surfing. And you need to be in surfing loose and relaxed. And if you're tense or fighting the wave will remind you who's in control.
It'll win. Yeah. All right. And so the next one then is it does have some similarities to what you were talking about in terms of just noticing, right? But it's a little like there's a part of it that is introspective, but it's also outrospective, right? So it's just called resting in open awareness. This is when I started playing with this one a lot this past summer for extended periods of time. It's very different from the focused attention ones. Like, so the box breathing is a great example of a very focused attention task, right? Belly breathing has a little bit of focus. Body scan is certainly a little bit of focus. In resting in open awareness, what you're trying to do is let your attention be diffuse, right? So you're not actually trying to focus on any one thing. Other than resting in awareness. So if there's a focus, it's awareness, right? So anything that is falling kind of on your sensory array, sounds that you hear, right? Sights that you see. So when I, this summer, when I was doing a lot of this, I would make my morning cup of coffee. I would sit in front of my picture window on the floor. I have my little meditation cushion, and I have a bird feeder outside of that, and the birds every morning are having a happy time. And I can just sit there and look at the trees and the sun and the birds and just rest in awareness. And like I said, this is something that when I started doing mindfulness, I really struggled with because I was always planning, always doing my, you know, we talk in mindfulness about the difference between being mind and doing mind. And, you know, my being mind was pretty absent, right? I was always doing. So That's a little bit of a preamble. But for this, I'm going to invite you to, you can close your eyes if you want. You can leave them open if you want to kind of look out the window, if there's a window near you, or if you're outside. You could certainly look around your office. Just, again, to start with, maybe do a nice kind of deep inhale and exhale. And then just allow yourself to notice things around you. It could be visual, could be auditory, it could even be kinesthetic. You might notice, you know, my shoes on my feet. And even noticing color, noticing texture. If you happen to be outside, noticing if there's any breeze, sound of birds. Again, allow yourself to notice whatever you notice in that non-judgmental way. So, coming back, I love this practice because this is another one you can do anywhere, right? If I'm standing in line at the grocery store, I can start noticing the color, right? Mm-hmm. When I walk across campus, I can notice the sunlight and, you know, the way the leaves rustle in the wind. It's really about just tuning in to where you are, right? We talked about that one of the common misperceptions in mindfulness is people like, well, I don't want to tune out, right? And it's the opposite of that. It's really tuning in. And so this resting in open awareness for me, it's just been a really enjoyable, kind of peaceful. I've gotten a lot out of that.
I know we're about running out of time very quickly. But it also reminds me of sort of the psychology tests. I don't remember who initiated the sort of gorilla and the basketball. Two people passing and you're given a task to say how many times do the people wearing the white t-shirts pass the ball and you miss the gorilla, you know, the guy in the gorilla suit coming in and doing a little dance in the middle of the group. It's something we miss. How much are we missing of our life day to day because we're so focused on just getting from doing A to B, the next task, that I you know, and even as you were queuing, I'm looking out the window, I notice the colors, like, oh yeah, we're coming into fall and the leaves are changing. Oh yeah, I do see the wind. Like it was all there.
Yes.
In front of me. I didn't necessarily notice it.
This is, and you and I give our, when we teach some of this, right? One of the challenges, we'll give students a challenge each week, right? As we go through the course. And one of the challenges we'll do is to say, every time you walk outside, right? To walk across campus or wherever you're going, just try and notice your environment, your surroundings. Because exactly, like I will go out of the building, walk across campus into another building and notice nothing.
Yep.
Right? Because I'm thinking about a meeting or an email or whatever, and maybe I'm on my phone and right, and I'm stuck in my head. Right? And this is one of the things we know that is I'll say not ideal for your mental health, right? You know, kind of being more present oriented really, really helps. So this might be a good time to just share a little bit about like our own journeys, right? Because you and I've played with different things. So Neil, I'm going to say, like, what is your current practice? And I mean, like, where, when, how? And I know it might not be a fixed thing because you and I are both tinkers.
But, I was about to say, like, you and I tinker and play. And I think I would invite people, like, what as we offer these, it's subjective. We are constantly tinkering and we're not offering these as prescriptions in any way, rather just this is what's working for us. And I think the more you can play and experiment to find the sequence or whatever, whatever that looks like or feels good for you. Cause yeah, you and I both continue to tinker and play. Of late, I have been getting up and taking a hot shower and then I take a cold shower. And this we can talk about.
Oh, yeah.
Sort of our about Wim Hof's work and cold therapy. I take a cold shower and then I do roughly about 10 to 15 minutes of yoga, 10 to 15 minutes of breath work, 10 to 15 minutes of mindfulness practice. And some of the ones we've explored today, some others that you might have heard of, sort of gathas or or visualizations. The structure remains the same. What happens within that structure, I tinker with. So sometimes I use Wim Hof's breathing. Sometimes I use the box breathing. Sometimes my yoga is more energizing. Sometimes it's more sort of relaxing, more stretching, and just mobility focused. But that's been The two pieces, the sort of cold therapy and the other part, has sometimes gone together, and sometimes has gone, like, sometimes I'll do that after the gym, which I do after that. I have breakfast and then I go to the gym. Sometimes it's after that. So where it falls I've moved around a bit,
yeah.
But that sequence has been really beneficial for me. How about you?
So yeah, I think the where or I would say when. For me, it's really key. Like, if I don't meditate early in the morning,
right,
I'm probably not going to do it. This is something I've learned about myself, right? So a commitment to meditate sometime during the day just doesn't work for me. It may work for you or someone else, or it doesn't work for me. So my habit is to get up, usually shower and brush my teeth and that kind of thing. And then I, before I eat, I do about 5 minutes of stretching. Yoga based stretches, just because my, body's stiff in the morning, and I find it easier to sit if I can open up my hips and move my back a little bit first.
Yep.
And then I sit, so I have a, just to get like real practical, I have like a nice yoga mat that I sit on, because my ankles are bony and I have a hardwood floor and I don't like my ankle's digging into the floor. And if you're sitting for 20 or 40 minutes, that really does matter. And then I have a meditation pillow, which a lot of people use to lift up my butt, right? So that my butt is higher than my knees. And again, all the comfort part, I want to get into a position where I'm not distracted by my body hurting or feeling like it's fighting the posture.
Right.
So I think that is something, that's very personal. All of our bodies are different. So you do have to, play with that, experiment. Yeah. Where is a comfortable position for you?
And my yoga is the same reason. I need to just like work out the kinks in my body, get a little movement in there. And I too, I ideally wanted for myself to do a morning and an evening.
Yeah.
My morning has been really consistent. I'm less consistent with the evening. So finding like where you might be a night person where you're like, I just feel like, and I know when I do it at night, my sleep is improved. I'm just less diligent about my evening practice.
Yeah. Right. Right. No, it's sometimes I will do it in the afternoon or evening, but like you, I it's just, it doesn't fit neatly anywhere in my schedule. And so, this, wherever it fits in your day, right, is a good place to do it. For me, this 20 minutes, often it is just the belly breathing. Like you, I'll go through periods where I do different things, right? I'll go through a phase of focusing on belly breathing. This summer, I did a long phase of resting and open awareness and really enjoyed that. I have been going through, periodically, I use apps for guidance, because I like to see what they're going to have me focus on that might be different in terms of a practice. So one of the ones I really like is the Healthy Minds Innovation. And this is created by Richard Davidson. He's on the faculty of University of Wisconsin-Madison. He's really one of the big names in mindfulness research. If you go through the app, it's a very full, like if you do a lesson a day with a guided meditation, it's like 4 months. Doing this daily, right? So it's a long course.
Is there a fee?
No, there's not.
That's amazing.
I'm guessing it was grant funded or something. Mm-hmm. The organization that he helps run is called Healthy Minds Innovation. It's a nonprofit, and I think he's just trying to disseminate this stuff out there, right, to encourage kind of happier people, right? Greater well being. Some of the other apps, right, do cost, like Headspace.
Right.
Like I find I've enjoyed that in the past. It's kind of pricey, in terms of the yearly subscription. But the Healthy Minds Innovation one has gone through. I'll say it's a little heavy on the guidance, right? So if you like long periods of silence, like I just had to accept that. Like I enjoy when I'm getting out of this guidance, mm-hmm. even though it's more guidance than I typically like.
But if somebody's starting, a little extra guidance might not be a bad idea.
It's actually probably a good thing. And you can also set on it like, okay, I'm going to sit for four. I think you can set anywhere from 4 minutes to 30 or 5 minutes to 30. And they do like – so there's – interspersed with the practice, there are mini lessons. And they're, when I say mini, they're like 5 to 8 minutes where they talk about some of the research, right? And so so you get into the science. It also ties with, you know, some Buddhist philosophy and tradition. So it's a very kind of thorough, like if you really want a nice introduction to mindfulness practice, it's probably the best one I can recommend.
So we're at time. You're going to hear us talk about mindfulness throughout our entire model of well-being. It's the foundation, I would argue, it follows through everything.
But mindful, you know, doing everything mindfully, right?
Which
is a little different than mindfulness meditation, right? I think we talked about this a little bit in episode one, that the mindfulness meditation is the practice that the deliberate practice that helps you really train your brain, train the habits of mind, so that you can be more mindfully present in a conversation or when you're walking across, right? Whatever you're doing.
Whatever you're doing.
In life. So yes, exactly. A lot of this we'll hear.
Thank you, my friend. Thank you, Phil.
Thank you, Neil.
That's it for this episode. If you have any questions or comments, or there is a subject you'd like us to discuss, please don't hesitate to reach out to ThriveologyLab@gmail.com. Thrive on, my friends.
Thrive on.